Россия и Беларусь. Крепкий союз.
Союз Беларуси и России стал настоящим флагманом.
Сегодня день единения народов России и Беларуси.
96 года в Кремле.
Президенты двух стран Борис Ельцин и Александр Лукашенко
подписали в Москве договор о сообществе Беларуси и России.
Two decades ago, two states proclaimed that they'd someday become one. And two decades ago, the first tentative steps to restore a lost empire began. The Russia-Belarus Union state turns 20 years old this weekend. And while this long effort at integration has itself proven to be less than advertised, in many ways it marked the beginning of Moscow's quest to revive its imperial glory and restore its dominance over the former Soviet space. So what does this ill-fated union teach us about that effort today? Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is still embedded, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hi there, Brian.
And joining us from Oxford, England, is Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and author of the books Belarus, the Last European Dictatorship, and the recently published Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West. Welcome back, Andrew. Good to have you.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Mark.
Andrew, why don't we start with you? Where would you place the formation of the Russia-Belarus state on April 2nd, 1996, in the broader sweep of Russia's post-Soviet resurgence? Was this indeed the beginning of the effort to restore dominance over the former Soviet space? Or was it a matter of political expediency as Boris Yeltsin faced a difficult re-election campaign later that year? How do you see this in the broader sweep of things?
Well, mainly the latter. You know, it was mainly short-term expediencies, but all with consequence. It grew out of a particular moment 20 years ago. The whole point being that at the time, the Russia-Belarus bilateral relationship wasn't typical of the relationships between Russia and the other post-Soviet states. There were things that Russia could get out of the relationship that it couldn't get out of its relationship with Ukraine or Armenia or whatever. Both sides were looking for short-term political gains. Yeltsin to get through his very difficult re-election in 1996. Lukashenko was also looking to get through 1996 to get Russian support for constitutional standoff against his opponents. Russia provided that. Lukashenko prevailed. Lukashenko was also seeking to play a role in broader Russian politics that we sometimes forget. He had sort of delusions or ambitions of being the kind of Russo-Belarusian Milosevic, serving maybe even as union president.
Yeah, he had his eyes in the Kremlin, didn't he?
Yeah, yeah. And it's not really part of the traditional narrative of how Putin took power. I mean, whether it was a realistic ambition or not, certainly the guys in the Kremlin didn't want this hick from the sticks, you know, playing the role that he wanted to play. So Project Putin was designed to forestall that possibility.
Mm. Yeah, because even as late as 99, people were worried that this was a distinct possibility. Mark, what are your thoughts? Where do you see this in the broader sweep?
Let's face it, this notion of yet another ever closer union that seems to be like the speed of light that you can always approach but never reach, I think clearly has come to very, very little. And I think it's fascinating precisely for the way that it shows up, that in imperial politics, it's often the subaltern states, it's often the weaker ones that actually can play the game, or use another metaphor, wag the dog more effectively. I mean, Lukashenko was, for a long time, he was the guy who was pushing for, you know, closer financial union and everything else, and it was the Russians who were actually backing away. So I think that, for me, this has always been, strip away the rhetoric, very, very much about convenience on both sides. And it's been a relationship in which precisely Lukashenko has realized that actually he does have cards to play that are wholly out of proportion with actually Belarus's economic, political, strategic position. And in that respect, I think in some ways it is something of a harbinger of the future, because one of the reasons, I think, why today Putin is being that much more muscular in seeking to assert Moscow's hegemony over Eurasia is precisely because, whether he's sort of fully conscious of it or not, he's operating in a world in which actually other countries are much more aware they have other options. Whether it's China, whether it's the United States, whether it's Turkey or whatever, depending on which country we're talking about, they're all looking for suitors. And therefore, Russia is having to sort of compete much more assiduously. And in some respects, Lukashenko was in that respect ahead of the curve.
Uh-huh. So you see this as a harbinger, but it's a harbinger not of Russia's resurgence, but of the limitations on Russia's resurgence.
Yeah, I mean, this is it. Russia never really... I mean, you know, Belarus... It was hard to think quite what Belarus can really offer beyond just simply another state, a certain propaganda point. There is still the strategic dimension of Belarus's role within the Russian air defense zone.
Yeah.
Which brings Russia's power
up to the Polish and Lithuanian border, and that's no small thing.
Well, we say Russia's power. I mean, again, you know, we're talking primarily about an air defense zone. I think, when one looks at it from Moscow's point of view, they actually see otherwise that quadrant being distinctly vulnerable from the West. However ludicrous and paranoid it may be, I think it's a genuine belief. So apart from that, really, it's very difficult to know quite what Belarus could and can offer Russia, except precisely that sense of feeling that it is the master of Eurasia.
Andrew, your thoughts, would you agree with this? A harbinger not of Russia's resurgence, but of the limitations on Russia?
Well, most of the advantages to Russia from the Union are symbolic. Belarus has always played an important role as kind of ally of last resort, the one true Soviet friend from the past. And the fact that Belarus is one of the three East Slavic states is also hugely important for Putin's kind of eclectic nationalism as it's developed more recently. There are other practical important matters of importance as well, a lot of which are informal. The military stuff is pretty much above board, but there's money that's made, particularly in the oil refining industry, that's always been usefully divided between the Belarusian and the Russian elites. There are services that Belarus can provide to the same elites, even to kind of Russian mafia, acting as a kind of outlier for arms exports or kind of grey economic areas. Even sort of the casino business, which has been sort of squeezed out of Russia. So Belarus kind of acts as a kind of offshore state for some of the things that Russia prefers to be offshore.
Mm. Now, there've been... Go ahead.
Metaphorically offshore.
Right, of course. even in the 90s, there were kind of two visions of what this union was supposed to look like. I remember a conversation I had with a Yeltsin administration official, and this was in the time after 96 when the union had already served its purpose in helping get Yeltsin reelected, and they were the Kremlin was kind of pushing away from it. And this was, you know, if Belarus wants to join Russia as a new subject of the Russian Federation, we're fine with that. But as a co-equal state in a union state, we're not so fine with that. And it was the latter that Lukashenko always saw this as, and the former that Russia did, correct?
Technically, Belarus has six oblasts, so it would get six new units in any potential union state. But the unequal geography, big Russia and small Belarus, has always been the problem. But the Union state was actually upgraded progressively, 96 through 99, and only reached its present form in the year 2000, which is obviously when Putin came to power, because he redefined the relationship in a way that no longer suited Lukashenko.
Mm.
But he found other ways of being useful to Putin, particularly as a bulwark against colored revolution, the West in general. It took him some time to reinvent himself, roughly until 2004, well, with the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. But he's found other roles that have been useful in terms of extracting resources out of Russia.
And he's reinventing himself now in a way of distancing himself to a degree from Putin's Russia, right? I mean, he's kind of carved out this role as a mediator in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. He's distancing himself from Russia's aims there. He said Belarus is not part of the Russian world. What's his game now?
Well, however realistic his ambitions or his fantasies were about playing a role in Russian politics in the late 90s, they're long gone. I mean, the other key anniversary that matters now is that he's been in power for 22 years now, mm-hmm. 20 years in 2014. So he's a great survivor. He's a statist. He's a boss. He's a Hoziyin. So preserving his local power, his local bailiwick, is what matters to him now. And the key issue there is whether he's in tune with the rest of the Belarusian population. There's some very interesting opinion polls taken in the last couple of years. Ordinary Belarusians want stability. They see a threat from Ukraine, but they don't value statehood and sovereignty in the way that Lukashenko does. I mean, for him it's simple. He wants to stay in power. Mm.
Mark, your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, absolutely agree on the various sort of often under-the-table advantages that Belarus can offer to the Russian state, or at least the Russians, if nothing else one can look at it. Certainly there were so many bank accounts in Latvian financial systems that were actually seemed to be owned by Belarus citizens who clearly were just simply acting for Russians in that respect. But what we see now is this interesting, I wanted to dwell on this interesting, the reinvention of Lukashenko, which again I think plays off this whole sort of wag the dog element. I mean, for a long time, in some ways, thinking about the Belarus-Russia relationship, when he felt that he really ought to be considered an equal player, even though he was vastly weaker. I mean, in some respects, I mean, that is to me tremendously reminiscent of how Russia looks at the world now. It looks to Washington and says, you know, we should be the two poles, even though clearly there is a massive disproportion in hard, soft, and every other kind of power between the two. But nonetheless, what Putin does have with America is a capacity to be inconvenient. Well, this is very much, I mean, in a way, Lukashenko's great virtue. He can come around and he can be useful to Russia. I mean, we saw at the beginning of the year, for example, a decision by the Russians not to, as was mooted, activate the Baranovichi airbase. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you know, some people sort of made, it's a Russian withdrawal or whatever. Well, it was nothing of the sort, actually, because at the same time, the Belarus Air Force decided to sort of take on some overhauled interceptors. So effectively, the Russians were getting the air defense they needed, but they weren't actually necessarily having to actually have their own people there. And meanwhile, they were passing on some secondhand S-300 missiles. So in this respect, Lukashenko can turn to Russia and say, look, we can still do this for you. You need this bit of your air defense ring sort of shored up. Give us some missiles and everything else, and we'll handle it. So that's Lukashenko the useful. But the point is, I think what's really changing now is Lukashenko is appreciating that there's so much more advantage in precisely building new, whether this is Lukashenko 2.0, 3.0, or 5.0, I don't know. But nonetheless, there's this new look, letting people out of prison so he can start to present himself as the new reformist Lukashenko. He's already,
which incidentally is how he ran in 94, if I remember correctly.
He is in this respect absolutely shamelessly effective and just simply playing whatever role. Although he promised he wouldn't, he's had to already to raise new taxes since his election. It's clear that after all, Belarus is in trouble. And looking at the opinion polls, there are more people say they're not happy with the way things are going than are happy. And so he's identified that basically being chummy with the West is probably going to be his best advantage to get rid of sanctions, and provides the West the opportunity to decide that they can use him against Putin. And I think this is what he's doing. He's basically, once again, he's putting himself up out in the marketplace. The original union was because he thought he would gain the most by his affiliation with Russia. Now, I think he's seeing that actually he can gain the most by appearing to be the anti-Russian Slavs. And frankly, the West is, after all, sufficiently eager for anyone whom they can kind of pit against Putin, that they're willing to more or less let bygones be bygones.
Now, I can't, listening to you, Mark, I can't help but recall a conversation I had here in Prague with a Belarusian woman I know who, to put it mildly, hates Lukashenko. She left because of him, studied here, stayed here, and continued working. And I was talking to her one evening about a year or so ago, and I said, you know, Zhenya, I know you don't like the guy, but I'm getting this grudging respect for him, the way he's standing up to Russia right now. And she just shrugged and said, yeah, he's a good gamer. He's a good gamer, which I think that really does sum it up. He's a damn good gamer, isn't he, Andrew?
Yeah. And one thing to add to Mark's point about the tail wagging the dog, I mean, far from the Belarus-Russia Union being a harbinger of Russia's re-imperialization more recently, in some ways it's the other way around. Once Russia embarked on this re-imperialization path, then it gave Lukashenko yet another new role or advantage, because Belarus was obviously crucial to all the various aspects of those of that scheme succeeding, particularly the Eurasian Economic Union when it was launched. Without Belarus, it would have been a failure at launch. And given that Belarus has not been particularly enthusiastic about the union, it has kind of died at birth anyway. He can play many roles at once, I think. Yes, there have been he's reinvented himself successively, but he's also capable of keeping many, you know, masks to hand simultaneously. He's not going to defect to the West, but he's maximized his advantage in the Ukraine crisis by posing as the anti-Russian Slav and by hosting, if not chairing, the Minsk negotiations, and by dragging his feet on all the security measures that Russia has asked him to take. I mean, we don't know where he's going to go next, but he's also been a good juggler as well as a player.
And if you look at, I mean, basically what I'm hearing from this whole conversation is Russia's really not getting what it really wants out of this relationship. And if Russia can't get what it wants out of Belarus, what does that say about Russia's ability to get what it wants elsewhere in the former Soviet space? Does it say that this effort's doomed? Andrew, I guess that's, well, I guess that can go to you and to Mark, but.
Well, it always goes in too heavy-handed, as we know, or at least recently it has, which is why Lukashenko, at least, has been spooked both by what happened in Ukraine over the last 2 years and by the kind of demands that came out of Russia on him in the wake, although, as Mark said, the saga with the airbase hasn't really been pushed by Russia as much as it might have been. Russia goes in strong. That puts off local elites. But Russia does have some empathy amongst local populations. So you're seeing a very interesting gap open up between Lukashenko and his sort of Slavophile support base at the moment. Particularly because most Belarusians still watch Russian TV. He's not been able to make any counter moves to kind of reduce that or shut it down. So he has statist motives for resisting Russia's heavy-handed pressure, but it's not clear that the rest of the population feels the same way.
Mark, your thoughts?
Yeah, again, I think we come back to the issue of Lukashenko as Putin's Putin. I mean, up to now, if one looks at countries in which Russia tries to lean, sometimes it's because it has objective strengths, economic or, if it's deployable, military. But often this is about will. This is about the fact that as Russia, as an essentially authoritarian country, doesn't have to worry about divided political structures, doesn't have to worry about free media and whatever. And therefore, you know, basically it can just do whatever it wants and focus its resources appropriately. Well, obviously with Belarus, it's dealing with another. You know, this is Putin's mini-me. And Lukashenko basically doesn't have, I mean, yes, of course, in the wider scheme of things, he has to worry about politics and the interests of the elite and the masses and so forth. But in day-to-day decision-making, Lukashenko decides what's going to happen. And therefore, actually, Belarus can be every bit as obdurate, if need be, as Moscow. And I think this is what really brings it up. It's actually that Russia tends to have relatively few cards it can play. It tends to be very good at bluffing, at warning, at creating an environment in which people feel uncomfortable or fearful. But if another country is actually able and willing to just simply stand up and say, what have you got? Then actually the answer is Russia often has very, very little.
So in this sense, I mean, as I was thinking, I mean, this is almost like, dare I say it, the advantages of this authoritarian state, because one of the reasons Russia was able to exploit Ukraine was it was able to kind of infiltrate its democratic structures, right? But Lukashenko's created a much stronger or harder state, I guess is the word I would choose to use there, that's much harder to penetrate him. Is the very authoritarianism of this state an advantage to Lukashenko in holding off Russia?
I would say that, yeah, I mean, authoritarian states are tough but brittle. When they break, they break. Democracies have far, far greater sort of resilience and so and general sort of cultural and systemic strength. But on the other hand, yes, democracies tend to be much more willing or able to be bamboozled. They have much
penetrated
more sort of internal
in the case
divisions.
Of Ukraine.
Yeah, well, in the case of Ukraine, I don't even think it's necessarily penetration. It's just simply a thoroughly self-interested oligarchic elite who are constantly sitting there thinking, well, what's in my own interests, rather than caring one whit about national interest. Mm. Whereas precisely in Belarus, you basically have a single guy making the decisions, caricaturing it slightly. And that gives it a phenomenal degree of strength right up to the point where actually, you know, maybe he goes too far or he's indisposed or all the other things that we've said about Putin himself. Mm-hmm. So, in this respect, actually, authoritarianisms do have, certainly in the first onset, considerable advantage.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, I heard you want to jump in.
Yeah, because Belarus isn't a democracy, and it's much harder to create a pro-Russian party or fifth column or fake NGO sort of spectrum than it is in other post-Soviet states. Mm. But because it's not a democracy, we don't know enough about the kind of deep workings of the state. We know a reasonable amount about Lukashenko because we've been studying him for so long, I guess 22 years now. But we know a lot less about the kind of deeper loyalties of the elite around him. And that might be where the kind of system is brittle. Mm. We don't know about the mechanisms, the kind of sticks and carrots that keep people loyal. We don't know enough about the kind of non-material factors, you know, patriotism, beyond sort of basic sinews of the state. You know, how patriotic are the Belarusian elite? After, you know, 25 years of independence, we don't know. We don't know how trustworthy the Siloviki are. They're certainly stronger than they were in Ukraine back in February 2014. I mean, we learned from the leak of the minutes of the National Security Council how they only had 5,000 combat-ready troops. Belarus is a quarter of the size, but it has 60,000. But we don't know enough about the kind of psychological loyalties of the elite. A lot of the KGB are Russian or Russian-trained. The army, the Belarusian army, has only just begun really to be disentangled from its Russian partner for security reasons. But we don't know the kind of long-term effects of the fact that many of the military leaders trained in Russia, or some are actually ethnic Russians. So we don't know enough about Belarus below Lukashenko, because it is an authoritarian state. We can make guesses. Hopefully he himself is better informed.
Mm. What did you make of those reports of a year or so back that Lukashenko was purging the so-called pro-Russian elements within the security services and the broader elite?
Yeah, we that's a kind of regular report that one hears. So the kind of regularity of it implies that there is a kind of structural problem.
Mm.
Belarus had Siloviki wars in which the supposedly pro-Russian faction were purged back in the mid-noughties. So it's not just a thing that came after the events in Ukraine, although that obviously sharpened the importance of loyalties. So it seems to be a kind of ongoing problem with the Siloviki. The army in particular, actually, possibly more than the KGB, because it has been so integrated with its Russian counterpart until fairly recently.
Well, Mark, you're our expert on Siloviki. You've indicated you want to jump in here.
Well, I think just I agree entirely that we don't know about the true workings of the elite, and one wonders how far Lukashenko knows. But I mean, I think there has been some interesting sort of suggestions, precisely of him trying to shore up his flank. Very recently, I think it was last month, I think it was, that the exceedingly wealthy businessman Yuri Chish, who had actually been on EU sanctions as Lukashenko's purse, in other words, his sort of money man, was actually arrested by the KGB. And again, one has to say, well, what does it say about a state that it keeps that particular acronym? But, I mean, and there's a variety of possible reasons for this. But, I mean, one of the ones that certainly seems to be playing more in here in Moscow is precisely he has very, very strong Russian business ties. So you have the probably second richest guy in Belarus, who is also very sort of closely tied with the Russians. Well, you know, if you look at places like Ukraine and Georgia, one can see how people might think, well, actually, this is exactly the kind of person who could be a vulnerability if we find our relationship with Moscow getting worse. And so, as I said, I mean, you know, I have no idea about the inner workings of the Belarusian KGB. But nonetheless, certainly here, that's what people are interpreting it as, actually this precisely being Lukashenko's attempt to try and ensure that he's as little vulnerable as possible to the Moscow factor at home.
Now, wrapping it up, yeah. I mean, oh, go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, you've also had some very interesting military reforms in the last couple of years. The one that really caught attention was Lukashenko rewriting the military doctrine to say that any appearance of anything that looked little
green.
And green and male would be treated as an act of war. And also subsequent changes to the training regime of the military to kind of train them in those kind of scenarios, and increase the size of the military in the long run to about 100,000. So it's not isolated. There is a kind of general tendency to shore up the state because he sees Russia trying to undermine statehood of all it, or the sovereignty of all its neighbours. And the starting point in Belarus is actually one of relative strength of the state and bureaucracy, certainly compared to what it was under Yanukovych. So Lukashenko's digging in for the long run, I see.
Now, summing it up, I mean, one of the comparisons I've often liked to make in terms of the Russian-Belarusian relationship is the relationship that Ceausescu's Romania had with the USSR and the Warsaw Pact. I mean, and not in any way to suggest that I expect Lukashenko to end in the same way that Ceausescu did. But what I mean is that Ceausescu was very skillful at playing a lot of different poles. I mean, he was playing with the Chinese, he was playing with the West, but yet he was a member of the Warsaw Pact, but not necessarily the most loyal member of the Warsaw Pact. He was a very authoritarian. It was a very authoritarian state, of course, much like Lukashenko's, although Lukashenko's isn't nearly as brutal as his was. Does this analogy hold up? Just to close out this section, I guess I'd ask you, the both of you, does that analogy hold up, do you think?
Well, it depends what broader metaphor you use. If it's balance, he's certainly not playing a game of equidistance between all these various other actors. His primary gain is with Russia, and he uses the other partners to get the most out of Russia. The relationship with China is useful, but it doesn't give him a kind of equal weight of possibility. The Chinese are very mercantilist. They're in Belarus for very specific financial reasons. Yes, they don't care about democracy or put political conditions on their loans, but they put quite strong commercial conditions on their loans. Most of the loans go the expenditure, the results from the loans go straight to China, back to Chinese business. The relationship with China is kind of slightly disappointing for Lukashenko. It doesn't give him the kind of freedom to ignore the primary relationship with Russia. And the same, actually, albeit slightly differently, with the relationship with the West. Russia knows that Lukashenko isn't going to completely defect. Right? He's not suddenly going to become a part of the West schemes like the Eastern Partnership or develop some kind of relationship with NATO. That simply isn't going to happen. It's more a kind of sense of frustration, to get back to this metaphor of the gamer. But he is primarily a Russian partner, but he's too slippery. He's constantly using the relationship with the other partners to redefine the primary relationship more to his liking than to Putin's.
Mark, your thoughts. Last word to you before we shift gears.
Yeah, I mean, and Andrew knows far more about Belarus than I, and I absolutely would defer to him. And I agree that given that, if nothing else, what Russia accounts for more than 40% of Belarus's exports, and I think more than half of its imports, or maybe it's the other way around. But anyway, it's an exceedingly sort of substantial trading partner, if nothing else. And so, yes, ultimately everything sort of is determined really in terms of its impact on the Moscow-Minsk relationship. But I think there's one interesting difference. I mean, I like the Ceausescu parallel. I think it works very well. But one of the things is the Warsaw Pact, after a certain point, to an extent, factored Romania out of the equation. They basically reckon that, except maybe in terms of a full apocalyptic sort of military Armageddon scenario, they basically wouldn't even think to count on Romania. On the other hand, and again, I keep going back to this sort of defensive element, because I do think this is about one of the few areas of the Belarus-Russia partnership which actually took real form. It was interesting that we saw recently the Deputy US Secretary of State for Defense visiting Belarus. Now, I don't think for a minute, because there's going to be some kind of military alliance, and if nothing else, Washington is very keen to not overplay this dimension. But I think this is actually one string that Lukashenko can tug in a way that Ceausescu couldn't, because that is the one thing that Moscow genuinely is concerned about. The one practical thing. Mm-hmm. It knows that Belarus isn't going to start not trading with it or anything like that. It knows that Belarus is not going to become part of the European Union or anything like that. But what it does know is actually Belarus, at pretty limited, if any, cost to itself, strategically or otherwise, could actually say, no, that's it, we're going fully neutral, get out. And that would cause serious problems for Russia and no real problems for Belarus.
Mm. Well, that's an interesting way to shift gears. Now, in a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and take a look at a report claiming that a virtual shadow government in Moscow is actually running the day-to-day affairs of separatist-held areas of Donbass. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is still embedded, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Oxford, England, is Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and author of the books Belarus, The Last European Dictatorship, and of the recently published Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rfrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Правительство Путина полностью руководит оккупированной частью.
Руководство в Донбассе осуществляется теневым правительством из Москвы.
Вице-премьер России Дмитрий Козак и заместитель
экономики Сергей Назаров.
Правительство в Донбассе только извещают о решениях, которые принимаются на высшем уровне в Москве.
Based on leaked documents, the German newspaper Bild is reporting that a virtual shadow government in Moscow is running the day-to-day affairs of the separatist-held areas of eastern Ukraine. According to the documents which this shadow government includes Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Kozak, a longtime confidant of Vladimir Putin, as well as Sergei Nazarov, Russia's Deputy Minister of Economic Development, and Leonid Gorin, the Deputy Finance Minister. It's responsible for such matters as finance, taxes, wages, public services, trade, energy, and transportation. In addition to exposing as a lie Russia's claims to being not involved in Donbass, but let's face it, we knew that anyway, this report seems to suggest that the Kremlin has long-term plans for the occupied territories, regardless of where they end up. Andrew, what's your takeaway from this? Does this add to our knowledge of what's going on in Donbass, or is this really old news in a new package?
Well, it shouldn't surprise too many people. The extent of Russian involvement was always major and massive, but it is extremely interesting in terms of where the separatist republics go next, where Russia wants to steer them next. The Bildt report refers to a specific meeting, I think last year, I can't remember the date, in which no members of the leadership of the rebel republics were actually present.
Exactly, yeah.
It's not even a kind of negotiating process. Although, interestingly, one representative of Rinat Akhmetov...
Yes, that is very interesting, actually.
A famous Ukrainian oligarch was present. There are all sorts of rumours in the Ukrainian press that the Russians want to make the republics a little bit more competent, a little bit less of an economic black hole, and a little bit more respectable. So turning them over to... Oh,
Akhmetov and Boyko are the two names I've seen floating.
Yeah.
I
mean, there's a big downside to all this. Part of the original revolt was populist, anti-oligarchical. Its supporters were very much concentrated in the kind of lower ends of society, or the people who had lost badly out under Yanukovych's rule. So there would be problems with steering back in that direction. But these guys aren't competent administrators. They're presiding over a total economic mess in which they're taking their particular cut. So clearly it's an attempt to partly normalise the situation insofar as that's possible. In which case, what's the division of labour? That's interesting. You know, why are the rebel republics' facade still there? I mean, they're useful for military threat, obviously. There's no real peace despite a relative ceasefire. In fact, there's been a kind of uptick recently. Yeah, and that's what clearly the primary purpose of the rebel leaders seems to be. They can't run the territories they administer, however, which is interesting.
Mark, what does this tell you about the long-term strategy?
Well, I mean, let me start actually by introducing a note of caution here, because, I mean, we have this report from Bildt, and very much it's really about the nuance of what's involved. And we haven't seen the text of these documents. We've been told that key experts have seen them and all validated them, but we haven't been told who. None of them were actually quoted. So, I mean, because my concern is, look, I don't doubt for a minute that this committee exists. We've seen other references to a committee. This obviously adds more detail.
And the names on the committee are interesting.
Yeah,
people
exactly.
Like Kozak. I mean, that's Putin's Mr. Fix-It.
Well, exactly. This is it. I mean, Kozak is a fixer, but he's also a very busy guy. We have here a commission that apparently meets every 2 to 4 weeks. Now, that is not running any area in any nuts and bolts thing. And what doesn't seem to be visible are the structures on the ground. Mm-hmm. Who actually does the work of this commission? You see, it makes perfect sense for there to be a commission of powerful figures within the Russian government, because we know the extent to which they're supporting this area. 70% plus of the budgets of these pseudo-states are being just simply shipped in by Moscow. That ultimately the military shield that is provided is by Russian troops from Moscow. You know, there's no question about that. But the idea that there is, I mean, this implies a degree of granularity of control, which I think it's still hard to actually say is proven. But that said, I mean, having stuck the boot in, I mean, you know,
put your caveats and your cautions out there as always.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, I mean, until we either see the documents properly. Or, and more to the point, until we actually see some structures to connect those committees to actual management on the ground, I think it's still an open issue. But what we do see is absolutely Moscow looking to try and find ways of regularizing its control over these the Donbass. We've seen it in the mysterious but not so mysterious murders of various rebel commanders who are that much more maverick and that much more outspoken. Clearly is an attempt to actually consolidate the grip over the militias of these sort of quote-unquote armed forces. We see this through the money direction. We see this in a whole variety of ways. Now, on one level, one can say, well, this is clearly about building up a huge Transnistria in the Donbass. That absolutely they want it to be a frozen conflict. And to do that, they have to have some halfway viable kind of state running it. And I think that's certainly one of the possibilities. But it's also necessary if they're actually even contemplating the thought of handing over the Donbass. Because the whole thing is they actually need to be able to deliver. At the moment, all they've done is essentially they have created chaos. So what I feel this is actually one way or the other is Moscow moving towards some sense of an end game, but in classic Moscow sense, trying to keep its options open both ways. I think they realize that the current status quo is no longer working for them. But I don't think they've yet decided exactly where they want to be 12 months hence.
So what are the options here, though? How does this work in the different scenarios? Because this is exactly was my line of thinking. Like, what does this mean? In the event of a frozen conflict, it's obvious what it means. But what if Minsk is fully implemented and the separatist held areas go back into Ukraine? Can Moscow maintain this kind of a structure without control of the border?
Well, I don't think it needs to. I mean, I think in a way part of the deal, and let's be honest, Minsk is. We're never going to have Minsk actually fulfilled. There will be something that is Minsky or Minskish, but it's not actually going to be Minsk. And let's be honest, Minsk was a bad deal.
Of course, it was. I said in a way, day one.
Sooner. Exactly, and the sooner we accept that, the better, and the West.
The Europeans are never going to accept that, but
but this is it. On the other hand, they're not willing to take the responsibility for the fact that they tried to impose a bad deal. But anyway, that's for another podcast. But let's say they do decide, and what they believe is Moscow believes it has some kind of a basis whereby it feels it can hand over this poison chalice that is the Donbass. That maybe they've struck a deal whereby Akhmetov and whoever will be the sort of the notional plenipotentiary representatives of Kiev, with a nod and a wink, and understanding that at the same time he's going to look after Moscow's interests there, or whatever. The thing is, to do that, Moscow needs to be able to actually pull out. Moscow needs to be able to disarm or otherwise neutralize those elements of the militia that can't just simply become quote-unquote local municipal policemen or similar. Moscow, at this point, actually, sort of, if something happens such that there can be a deal, let's say Ukraine decides that it's going to accept greater sort of limitations than it thought, or things go that badly for Russia that it feels it just has to pull out. Nonetheless, it has to be able to deliver. And I think this is its problem. Up to now, it's enjoyed the advantages of chaos. Now it feels that it needs to do something to begin to try and rein in that chaos. Mm.
The interesting thing about Akhmetov, too, is if he's this is the one guy, I don't think Moscow or Kyiv fully trusts Akhmetov, because Akhmetov is out for one guy and one guy alone, and I think we all know who that one guy is. Andrew, your thoughts?
Yeah, his prominence is interesting. The Minsk process is so flawed that really we're not talking about the kind of end stages at all. The key question of who controls the border, etc. We're much more interested in the kind of feasible short-term steps. And this report does make elections a little bit more plausible or feasible, local elections in the occupied areas, because it does seem to possibly indicate that Moscow is interested in a kind of stabilization of the local power structures, some kind of power sharing between the original militias and the oligarchical element. And it's probably a safe exclusion, safe assumption that other parties are excluded. The Ukrainian parties per se wouldn't have much of a chance in the election because of all their supporters have left. And that the kind of fake parties set up by Kiev that operate elsewhere in East Ukraine,
so-called Nash Cry and other things, they wouldn't have much chance in Donbass elections either. The problem with holding elections is mainly internal to Ukraine, and with getting the kind of necessary measures through the Ukrainian parliament, with the government sort of losing its majority as we speak, or trying to reformat itself as we speak. But it does indicate a sort of possible willingness on the Russian side to move in that direction. The interesting thing about Akhmetov, though, many interesting things, his main objective, of course, is to preserve his own economic interests, but they are divided. He has some on the kind of rebel side of the lines and some on the Ukrainian occupied side, particularly in Mariupol, which traditionally was the big in-out for his other businesses. Supplies came in, exports came out. So it's interesting what all of this would imply about the kind of hardness of the borders of the de facto republics going forward, because Akhmetov's interest is in keeping goods travelling across those borders, despite the kind of militarization of said border.
What, Andrew, what did you make of this report in terms of what it tells us about Russia's long-term plans? Did this change your thinking on what those might be? I mean, it didn't change my thinking, but it made me start to reassess my thinking a little bit.
I mean, Mark's very right to sort of be cautious about the kind of, well, not so much the reliability of the report as what it tells us and what it doesn't tell us. I mean, it tells us that in 2015, Moscow began picking up more of the bills. Not all of them. Doesn't want to pay all of them by any means. But 70% of whatever the budget is a figure that I've seen as well. So that makes perfect sense. If you're paying the money, you have a committee to look over where it's going and how it's being spent and whether it's being stolen. So the report doesn't tell us anything more about the actual workings, division of labour on the ground, who's in charge of what, etc. So it tells us that Russia is interested in looking after whatever money it's providing. It tells us that Russia has short-term priorities of stabilisation. The kind of humanitarian economic situation is so bad in the occupied areas. In order to keep its longer-term options open. Russia may have been sort of slightly outmaneuvered in the last round, but it sees it as a process of many rounds, rather. It still wants to destabilize Ukraine. It's gone in and out of Syria to whatever degree it's scaled back. It has the option of rescaling things back in Ukraine. All of those options need to be on the table, I think, for Moscow. Mm. And there are many types of frozen conflict. In Kiev, one often hears talk of good frozen conflicts, which is basically the Transnistrian scenario.
Mm-hmm.
You actually isolate the region, you don't pay the bills, and you basically forget about the region and get on with running the rest of your country.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the kind of frozen conflict scenario that Russia wants, and not what it's working towards.
Speaking of Kyiv now, do you see them moving towards that so-called good frozen conflict scenario? Because I've seen different indications that they may be moving in that direction.
Well, the Minsk agreement is flawed in many ways, one of which is that it doesn't actually allow that kind of scenario. These regions are supposed to be constitutionally reintegrated to some degree. It's clear that although elections might be possible, then the other political parts of the agreement that are supposed to go around that are no longer possible because Kyiv does not have the 300 votes in the Rada in Parliament that it needs in order to pass constitutional change.
Right.
So in that sense, the formal way through the rest of the Minsk process is basically not possible.
Right. And some of the speculation that I've heard along these lines is one of the ways that that Poroshenko might try to square that circle, so to speak, is to hold a national referendum on the future status of the occupied territories, which would give him the political cover to go for that kind of frozen contract. He'd break Minsk, of course, but it would give him the political cover to go for that kind of so-called good frozen conflict. Do you see that as a viable option?
Yes. It would be controversial, but it would be a prelude to trying to renegotiate the whole peace agreement. And whether Europe is keen on that is another question. Particularly because the softening of sanctions against Russia have been so clearly linked to the implementation of the agreement. So there are actually downsides to scrapping a bad agreement as well.
Mm. Mark, last word to you before we wrap it up. Your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think the problem is that at the moment, obviously we have in Moscow a regime that can make tough decisions if it chooses to, but is choosing not to. And in Kiev, we have a regime which, frankly, finds it difficult to make substantive decisions, both because of character and also because of political position.
And because Ukraine's a democracy and Russia's not. One guy can make the decision in Russia. You need 300, as Andrew pointed out, to make
well,
the decision.
Well, I mean, this is it. If it's something that precisely has to go through the radar, it does become exceedingly problematic. But, I mean, even in terms of a willingness to go down in flames for just to try and make the case for something that one thinks is important doesn't seem to be there in Kiev. And this is not to beat up on Kiev. I think it's actually to say that I think the trouble is we can speculate on a whole variety of potential scenarios. What I find increasingly difficult is actually trying to truly game one through and actually say, well, okay, how could this actually happen? It's very hard at the moment until we see something changing from one of the many protagonists involved. It's very hard at the moment to see anything other than just a slow rigidification of what's there now. And yes, the Russians will try and make their little pseudo-states a little bit more professional, and meanwhile Kiev will try and get its act together a little bit more. But nothing that's actually going to break this current situation at the moment. Maybe I'm just in particularly pessimistic mode today.
Well, no, that's I think I would concur with that, and that's a good note to wrap up on. We've covered a lot of ground today: Russia, Belarus, Russia, Ukraine, and I guess we can wrap it up for the weekend. So that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Join me on the Skype line from Moscow, where he is still embedded, is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us from Oxford, England, has been Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations and author of the books Belarus, The Last European Dictatorship, and the recently published The Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Always a pleasure.
Always a pleasure here, too. I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, whom you can follow on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.